From Huntington to Reading, Somerset to Warminster, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania faces a number of financial ticking time bombs. Among those are Medicaid costs. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Matthew Briette from Commonwealth Partners and Elizabeth Stell of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capital Watch look at the program. And as important as what did pass the General Assembly before summer break is what was proposed but did not pass. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The race for Pennsylvania's seat in the U.S. Senate has played out in the shadows of the gubernatorial race as GOP nominee Scott Wagner and Governor Tom Wolf battle for the chief executive's job. But the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to a vacant seat on the Supreme Court has suddenly thrust the Senate race into the spotlight, and a war of words has erupted between incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. and his Republican opponent, Congressman Lou Barletta. Casey, of course, is a no vote on confirming Kavanaugh and has accused the president of striking a, quote, corrupt bargain with the right, end quote. That, of course, referring to the fact that as a candidate, Donald Trump put forth a list of potential Supreme Court nominees that had been vetted by the conservative Heritage Foundation, among others. Barletta defended both the process and the nominee, saying President Trump's selection was highly transparent and voters should expect the same thing from the Senate. Complicating matters for Casey is the fact Donald Trump carried Pennsylvania on his way to winning the White House. Thus, a vote against Kavanaugh risks igniting the Republican base against Casey. Senate hearings will begin in a couple of weeks, and a confirmation vote is expected prior to the start of the new Supreme Court term, which begins the first week of October. Democrats have failed to make inroads into the GOP's strong majority in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, but Republicans seem to be doing their best to do their job for them. A second Republican lawmaker has resigned in as many weeks. Representative Hal English, whose district is in the North Hills of Allegheny County outside of Pittsburgh, announced he will not seek a fourth term. The Republican Party will now have to name a replacement candidate to appear on the November general election ballot. The district is considered to be competitive, although Donald Trump carried it by 7 points in 2016. The new GOP nominee will face Democrat Betsy Monroe for a chance to represent the district. Representative Eli Ivankovic of nearby Westmoreland County, who was not seeking re-election, resigned his seat 2 weeks ago, effective at the end of this month. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, along with a number of media outlets and now victims, are pushing the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to allow release of a grand jury report into sexual abuse by members of the Catholic clergy. The report was to have been made public several weeks ago, but the high court stayed the release after some who were named in the report but never charged with wrongdoing objected. The court did give the attorney general the option of filing additional arguments in favor of its release, which he has done. Exactly where the case stands is unclear, as such matters operate under a veil of judicial secrecy. Read about all things Pennsylvania on the all-new patownhall.com. Like all health care costs, the cost of the Medicaid program has grown exponentially over the past few years. Our Capital Watch crew is here to explain what the program is, who it serves, and what financial challenges lie ahead. Joining host David Taylor, our regular panelists, Matt Briette, and their guest, Elizabeth Stell from the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Matt Briette, President and CEO of the Chamber of Entrepreneurs Commonwealth Partners. Matt, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, good to be with you, David.
And we want to talk about, you know, we're always talking about competitiveness, about the size and the cost of government. And in particular, we want to talk about one of the main cost drivers of the Commonwealth's budget, the Medicaid program. To that end, want to welcome our special guest from Pennsylvania's free market think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, Liz Stell, the Director of Policy Analysis. Liz, thanks for being part of our conversation today.
Well,
thank you for inviting me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, so we'll start, Matt, I'll start with you. You know, we just completed the fiscal year 2018-2019 budget, and that it went fairly smoothly. That's not to say that it went well, just that it went smoothly, that everybody has something that's passable to put up until the, you know, re-election comes. And then there were all kinds of whisperings, you know, well, this budget, you know, it will be the last good one, and then things are going to get hard next year. Why do we expect things to get hard next year?
Well, things are going to get hard because we're continuing to spend more money than what we've got. We shifted lots of money, one-time revenues, in order to be able to, well, get out of town here in an election year. Governor Wolf finally signed a budget after four. He didn't sign three of them. Mm-hmm. Finally signed one, which, of course, contained all of the things that he railed against for the previous 3 years of gimmicks. So we had a lot of gimmicks in this. We've delayed payments. One-time revenues that are going to disappear, that next year it's going to be battle royale once again with the budget because of, well, they've built this budget without sufficient ongoing revenues because we continue to spend far more than what we have.
And, you know, one of the things that's driving the costs of state government is, and this was one of the key distinctions in the last gubernatorial election, that, you know, then Governor Tom Corbett held the line and he said expanding Medicaid outside of its parameters, which up until then had been poor senior citizens, poor people with disabilities, and poor expectant mothers or new mothers, that under Obamacare, that the program could have been dramatically expanded to include able-bodied people of working age who have no dependents. And so that was one of the things that Governor Tom Wolf said he would do if elected, and that's what he did. And Liz, what has that done to Pennsylvania's fiscal condition?
Well, our Medicaid program was already a major cost driver before the expansion underneath Obamacare. But since 2014-15, when the expansion really took off, we've seen the problem just escalate. We now have about 700,000 healthy adults on the Medicaid program. But what's more concerning to me is not so much the number, but the fact that almost 500,000 of those healthy adults have no income. So we're not helping people. We're essentially allowing them to be trapped in dependency. And that's very concerning. When you look at just the cost of Medicaid, Dave, it's roughly 37%, getting to 40% of all operating budget spending.
Yikes.
That's enormous. Yeah, and it's growing faster than our revenue. It's growing faster than our state economy. So when you keep adding new populations to an unsustainable program, it doesn't make it any more sustainable.
Well, Liz, what makes it, you cite the numbers of 500,000 people that have no income. Are these people that just simply can't work, that we have to pay for their health care costs, that they are unable to provide for themselves, and this is just part of that safety net that we've crafted here in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's important to make the distinction. With the Medicaid expansion, you are expanding the program primarily to healthy, or what they call able-bodied adults. So these are people that don't have a disability that should be able to go out into the workforce, and they're people that don't have young kids at home, so they don't have to deal with childcare. So on the surface, there's no reason these people shouldn't be able to contribute, and there's actually legislation in the House that's now sitting in the Senate to have these people work part-time or even volunteer part-time in order to maintain their Medicaid benefits. And the idea here is not to punish anyone, not to create hoops to jump through. The idea is to help people get to that better condition in life so they're not dependent on Medicaid for health care, because quality-wise, it's not a very good program.
Liz, I want to expand a little bit on the point that you just made about the having a work requirement for people who are able to work in order to receive these benefits. And that, I will attest, this is not meant in any way to be punitive. This is to help people to gain the skills that will render them employable in the future. That for anybody who's out of work, you soon discover that the longer that you're on the sidelines, the less valuable you are because you're dormant and your skills are eroding. And so for people who are in this situation in life, for them to have to be seeking work, to have some kind of positive activity that would give them some kind of credential that a future employer could refer to say, hey, well, I worked with this charitable organization. I worked part-time at this particular job. I went to school to get this particular kind of training. All of those things make the individual more valuable, and that's ultimately what we should want.
And when they've applied this work-first approach to other entitlements, specifically food stamps, they've seen tremendous results. In Kansas, 75% of healthy adults left the food stamp rolls when they were required to work. And more importantly, they increased their income in the year after they left the rolls. So that's exactly what we want to happen. You know, we want people to earn more. We want them to get employed. We want them to have higher quality lives. Just putting more people into the Medicaid system is not success. In fact, there's been studies that show expanding Medicaid actually discourages people from, you know, going into the workforce and from trying to find a job after they've been out of work for some time.
Well, and when you do that, Liz, this is where, yes, we talk about the cost to taxpayers and not being able to afford it, but the human costs of the people trapped in these systems when they become dependent rather than being independent and responsible for their own lives, it creates a generational cycle of dependency. I think the quality of life for people trapped in these systems has been demonstrably less than those who actually have to earn their way, and that there is a real benefit for the poor when they earn their success or earn their benefits. And so this is really a win-win for taxpayers and the people who may have needed a safety net for a time, but then become independent.
To go back to Liz's point that we as a society are all poorer when our fellow citizens aren't able to realize the potential that God gave them, and to have the dignity of work, to have them pursuing their best selves, which can only be done by, again, engaging in the world and deploying your talents. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me on the program, Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners and Liz Stell from Commonwealth Foundation. Matt, in the past, I've heard you comment about Medicaid being a program that not only is it expensive to the taxpayers, but it also is very poor and ineffective in serving the people who are in that program. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I think that Liz can certainly speak to the quality of care. And I think it is important that we say, hey, we're not just saying no to these programs or we shouldn't provide these to people, but there are actually better alternatives. Not only the work requirements that Liz has noted, and I think she gave some good examples of where states have implemented these things, that the poor actually do far better for themselves. What are the alternatives to this? How could we do this better? How do we make sure that we maintain that safety net? But it is only a safety net, not a hammock that people can stay and lounge in for their entire lives and then even generationally. But what are the things, Liz, that we could do on the systemic scale that would make sure that we provide the safety net, but also move people to independence rather than the dependence?
Well, there are an array of options. The big obstacle has always been the federal government because Medicaid is administered primarily by the states, funded half by the states, half by the federal government, but the federal government sets the majority of the rules. So it's a very convoluted process. It's hard to administer, and those federal barriers have really held states back in terms of innovation and making the quality of the program better. But with the change in the Trump administration signaling the ability to do work requirements, I mean, that's a game changer. I mean, by far, work is the most transformative thing we can do. On top of that, creating a Medicaid system that looks more like private insurance in the sense that you have a copay or you have a deductible that you pay, but, and this isn't a key part, it tracks with your income. Right now we have a situation where you go from paying nothing for your Medicaid to paying all of your health insurance after you reach a certain income cap. And most people can't do that. Most people can't get, you know, a couple dollar raise and then all of a sudden be able to afford, you know, an Obamacare exchange plan that has, you know, a $400 monthly premium and a, you know, $12,000 deductible. So in order to make it realistic, you have to slowly scale, you know, the premium or the copay. Or you could just allow people to do a voucher to take a certain set of dollars and say, okay, I'm just going to go out and purchase my own health care. And that way you, again, have more personal responsibility, you have more choice, and you don't have all the issues of providers not taking Medicaid because of all the red tape and strings attached.
Well, and Liz, that is one of the most important points that I wanted to touch on here, that health insurance is not the same thing as health care. And that one of the challenges is because under the Medicaid system that the reimbursement to physicians is less than it would be through private insurance, that there are many physicians, many doctors' offices that just won't take any more Medicaid patients. And so you have people who qualify for a program, but that the pool of providers keeps shrinking. And that itself is one of the things that makes Medicaid a high expense, low quality program.
Now, Pennsylvania does better than other states in terms of access, but that's not saying a lot when you're looking at just Medicaid. Let me give you a quick story of someone I met named Amanda, who used to be on Medicaid, but went through a training program and now has, you know, a good paying job as a medical assistant in rural Pennsylvania. I asked Amanda, you know, what her Medicaid experience was like when her family was in that situation, and she said she was really thankful for the assistance. But one time her daughter needed to see a specialist, and that's a lot of times where people run into problems. And they had to drive 2 hours to Pittsburgh to see this specialist. So they drove all the way there, and they got to the doctor's office, and the doctor said they couldn't be seen. And they couldn't be seen because her local doctor, her primary care doctor, hadn't sent a referral. So they had to wait extra time for that referral to come through or, you know, drive back and come back another day. So that's just a small example of some of the access problems that people on Medicaid face.
Liz, as we look at the total budget, the spending in Pennsylvania, I know that Human Services, or what we used to call Department of Public Welfare, through which a lot of these services come through, is the largest already budgetary item and the fastest growing. I mean, what kinds of growth are we looking at in the future? And how does this, you know, portend for future budgets that are going to be dealt with? I mean, can we keep pace? And what's the result if we can't? Are we talking about massive tax increases? Are there going to be cuts? I mean, given that this is a federal and state program, what do you see the future of Medicaid and other such programs?
Well, Medicaid is growing, depending on the year, between 4% to 7% on its own. Revenue, you know, 2% to 3%. So every year you see this, we're pushing more resources into Medicaid, which means we can't do other things in the budget, or we find more one-time funds or do more shifts so that we can still fund all of our other priorities we want, because it's really difficult to say, all right, we can't spend as much on education or public safety or transportation because we have to spend more on Medicaid. Certainly there's going to have to be really tough decisions down the road if lawmakers are not willing to look at work requirements, and if the federal government does not come down with some transformative Medicaid reform like the block grant talk that was very prevalent last summer during Obamacare repeal discussions.
Well, Liz, we started out this discussion talking about this current fiscal year budget that was done and that it was built on a lot of one-time revenues. I think a part of that was the Medicaid spending.
Yeah, so what we did is we took basically the last batch of tax revenue from an old tax on managed care providers that the federal government said was illegal, and we used that to plug up a bunch of our needs in Medicaid. We also took some money from tobacco settlement fund, took some money from some other places, and then actually shifted some of that spending out of the general fund into the shadow budget. So we're not exactly sure how much more we threw into Medicaid this year, but it looks like, you know, anywhere from the neighborhood to $6 to $8, maybe $100 million that they threw offline to increase Medicaid spending.
So we're already looking at $600 to $800 million whole in next year's budget, at least. And that's just the Medicaid portion. Is that accurate to say?
I think it's close to that. I would say 400 definitely. They could borrow from Tobacco Settlement Fund again. Those funds come to the state every year, and they just disperse them in different ways every year. So, yeah, I mean, you're definitely looking at hundreds of millions of dollars. What happened in the past is Governor Wolf just simply had overspending in DHS, and so we had all these supplemental appropriations that we had to somehow find a way to pay for after the fact. So I think that's also very likely part of the picture we're going to be looking at come next year.
Is there anything that the Wolf administration is doing that you would applaud or say they're doing this well or managing this well? Or is this kind of like, oh, we're going to let this program get flooded and we don't care how much revenue we've got, we're just going to keep expanding it?
Well, I guess I would say they've been successful at recruitment. Well, I don't think that's necessarily measure of success. They have added a lot of people to the roles. One thing that the administration has been, you know, I've been very disappointed in their response to work requirements. They've been outright hostile to any of those proposals, which I think is a really big missed opportunity. So I can't say that they're advancing any good policies. But that said, this certainly isn't a lost cause. There's a lot of good legislation out there. There's a lot of momentum. Two-thirds of Pennsylvanians polled support work for Medicaid. So I think we're actually making progress in terms of seeing some of those transformative reforms happen.
Well, Liz, thank you for being part of the program. I guess the concluding thought here is that, as ever, you can ignore the laws of economics, but you cannot annul them. And so we will keep fighting for dignity, for opportunity, and for a better commonwealth for all of us. Liz, that's all the time we have. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work and the Commonwealth Foundation?
So you can find all of our research on Medicaid at commonwealthfoundation.org. And in there, you'll see a section on welfare and healthcare, and you can find all our research there. You can find us on Twitter at Liberty4PA.
Outstanding. Matt, where can people go to learn about you and the work that you're doing?
Yes, go to thecommonwealthpartners.com or facebook.com/commonwealthpartners.
And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Matt and me, thanks again for Liz being on the program. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Mark Twain once observed that no man's life, liberty, or property is safe when the legislature is in session. He was talking about the federal Congress, but the saying can aptly be applied to the legislatures in the states as well. And so it is with the Pennsylvania General Assembly, which this year gets an extended summer vacation after having a state budget in place for the first time in 4 years by the July 1st deadline. Lawmakers quickly exited the state capitol and are not due back until mid-September. For the time being, our life, liberty, and property are safe. More important than passage of the state budget or anything else approved by the legislature so far this session is what they did not do. A wide range of proposals that would have infringed on our liberty and taken our property bogged down in the legislative process. In his budget address, Governor Tom Wolf again proposed a severance tax on Pennsylvania's natural gas industry. This tax has become the holy grail of the tax, spend, then tax some more crowd. Gas producers in the Marcellus Shale region already pay the same taxes every other business and industry in the state pays, plus an impact fee. The governor has support for a severance tax from all legislative Democrats and a handful of wayward Republicans. Even that was not enough to get his tax plan included in the budget that ultimately passed. Wolf yielded to political reality and signed the budget without the severance tax. Another Wolf initiative, raising the state's minimum wage, also failed to pass legislative muster. Such an increase might temporarily benefit a few, but surveys of business owners and chief executive officers conducted by the Lincoln Institute have found most would cut hours, eliminate jobs, or even go out of business entirely if the minimum wage were raised. The ultimate impact would be fewer job opportunities for those at the lower end of the jobs ladder. The legislature also yielded not to a plot by national Democrats to change the process by which congressional and legislative district lines will be drawn after the 2020 census. Democrats lost thousands of state legislative seats during the Obama presidency, and this resulted in Republicans gaining control of the redistricting process in most states, including Pennsylvania. With the 2020 census approaching and a redrawing of lines set to take place in 2021, Democrat front groups like Fair Districts PA and the League of Women Voters pushed for changing the decades-old procedure of redistricting via an open legislative process to having a so-called Citizens Commission draw the lines. Republicans hold a two-thirds majority in the state Senate and a historically high majority in the state House, meaning chances of Democrats gaining control of either by 2020 is highly unlikely. Were Democrats to lose the governor's office this year, the GOP would again have total control over the process. While professing to want a Citizens Commission to prevent gerrymandering of the districts, the real motivation behind the push was to enhance Democrat control over the process. The impact would have been to remove redistricting from lawmakers accountable to we the voters to citizens with no accountability with anybody. Legislation to change the process drew hundreds of proposed amendments. It was clear no consensus had emerged. As a result, so-called redistricting reform died, at least for the time being, when the House gaveled into recess. Personal liberty also came under attack in the form of several legislative proposals designed to chip away at rights of Pennsylvanians to keep and bear arms. There are those who believe the way to curb the school shootings that have taken place across the nation is to add further restrictions on the rights of law-abiding gun owners. Efforts to do just that perked through the various legislative committees, but failed to make it to the floor for a vote. It is not unusual for non-fiscal issues to fail to get a hearing in the month before the state budget deadline. The importance of what did not happen is amplified this year because the current legislative session ends on November 30th, meaning all legislative proposals reset to the start of the process when the new General Assembly convenes in January. Sometimes what does not happen is as important as what happens. And for now, we the people of Penn's Woods are safe from assault on our liberties and properties. But the battle will resume when the legislature returns in September. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 23 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCNS-AM in La Trobe, WWSM-AM in Lebanon, along with WJSM-FM in Martinsburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
We'll be right back.